Okay, folks, if I can interrupt your conversations. I hope you enjoyed your main course. So we're going to have a bit of a break now and hear a bit from Christopher Ash, who is our guest speaker for the evening, to speak on where can I find enlightenment. So Christopher used to be the minister of a church and is now running a course teaching people how to teach the Bible. So you can give your scores at the end whether you think he's done a good job. But that's what he does for a living. He's the director of a course teaching people how to teach the Bible. And we're delighted he could be with us this evening. Thanks, Christopher.
Thank you, Marcus, very much. Slightly alarming to have an introduction like that. I'd be really grateful. On the tables, there's a little pile of John's Gospels. And I'd be really grateful if you could pick one of those up and turn up page... Let me find the page. Page 29. And I'm going to refer to some things that Jesus said there. Let me start with an extraordinary thing that Jesus said. Jesus said on one occasion, he said, the reason I came into the world is so that blind people might get to see and so that sighted people might go blind. That extraordinary thing to say. Have a look at page 29, near the top. The little figure for verse 39, just a little way down from the top. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." And I want to explore that a little bit in the few minutes I've got. Yesterday evening, and just a few of you were here yesterday evening, I talked about desire and frustrated desire, and how to find satisfaction. And this evening I want to talk about enlightenment, how blind people get to see. And I'm going to come back to that extraordinary saying of Jesus, the reason I came into the world so that blind people might see and sighted people might go blind. I've been reading Christopher Hitchens' bestseller, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. I don't know if any of you guys have read that. It's a vigorous journalistic rant against all religion, Christianity included. And in his conclusion, Hitchens quotes an 18th century German called Gotthold Lessing, who said that if God held out to him in his right hand all truth, and in his left hand the steady and diligent drive for truth, albeit with the proviso that I would always and forever err in the process, and offer him the choice. So say to him, you can either have all truth, or you can have the business of driving and trying to find truth, knowing that you're always going to get it wrong. And Lessing said, I would always humbly choose God's left hand, on the basis that seeking truth is a better thing than actually finding truth. And Hitchens goes on to make the usual postmodern claim that anybody who claims to know the truth is fooling themselves and trying to fool us and probably trying to intimidate us with their oppressive religion. So Hitchens says what we need at the end of his book, he says, is a renewed enlightenment, by which he means a renewal of the 18th century enlightenment, the supremacy of reason. And we need to understand, he says, that the proper thing to study is human beings, and that there's nothing beyond human beings. So according to Hitchens, the best we can hope for is a perpetual seeking after truth, knowing that we're never going to find it. It's a little bit like in Homer's Odyssey, where the myth of Sisyphus, who's condemned by the gods to roll this great big boulder uphill, but it keeps rolling down to the bottom and he has to start again. And that's pretty much what we've got, according to them. Except that, of course, people like Hitchens are absolutely sure that it's absolutely true that all religions are wrong, which is a nice irony. So there is one truth they seem to be confident that they've found. Well, there's one approach to enlightenment. Another approach, of course, is in Eastern religions like Buddhism, where the Buddha, or the Enlightened One, about 500 BC, sitting under a tree, is supposed to have said, my mind was emancipated, ignorance was dispelled, knowledge arose, darkness was dispelled, light arose, as he realized that this world is illusion, maya, and that enlightenment is achieved when we go beyond desire to non-existence or nirvana. That's another approach. Well, here's a third approach. I was reading a book by Eckhart Tolle, who's a favourite author of Oprah Winfrey. I don't know whether that commends him to you or not, but in his book A New Earth, which is a kind of New Age book, he says that truth, with a capital T, is to be found within ourselves. You are the truth, he says. If you look for it anywhere else but within inside yourself, you're going to be deceived every time. So where do we look for enlightenment? Do we look to a Buddhist embrace of nirvana, or where do we look? And Jesus says that he comes to bring enlightenment, and also, if I can coin the word, endarkenment. He says he comes so that blind people will see and sighted people will go blind. And I want to explore this with us a little bit. John's Gospel begins by saying that right at the heart of the universe, there's the Creator God and his eternal Son. And that when his Son came into the world, he brought light with him. And later on in John's Gospel, in chapter 3, John's Gospel says that light has come into the world, but people loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. Which is really significant, because what John's Gospel is saying is that light in the New Testament is not so much an intellectual category as a moral category. Light in the New Testament is not so much about understanding as about right and wrong. Light and darkness are about good and evil rather than just understanding, just an intellectual thing. I'd love us just to have a look for a few minutes at John chapter 9. So turn back, if you would, to the beginning of the chapter, page 26, where John chapter 9 starts. And I want you just to talk us through a little bit of this story, because in a way it sums up some of the Christian good news. So it begins as Jesus went along. He saw a man blind from birth. And the man blind from birth is intended in John's Gospel to be not just literally true, but also to be a kind of picture of what human beings are like, that by nature we don't get it. By nature we are blind from birth. There are important things that we just don't understand. And the disciples asked Jesus, "Rabbi or teacher, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" In other words, it's a sort of karma type question. Presumably, if he's born blind, either he did something wrong in his mother's womb, or his parents did something wrong. Somewhere in the past, there must have been wrong stuff. And Jesus says, verse 3, that you're asking the wrong question. But actually, we need to look to the future. And God's going to do something, verse 3. The work of God is God's going to do something in his life. And he goes on, he talks about that a little bit. He sends the man off to wash in verse 7, and the man comes back and sees. Oh, just have a look at verse 6. Jesus, curiously, he spits on the ground and he makes a little mud pack with the saliva and the mud and puts it on the man's eyes, strangely, but it's going to be significant later on. Now, the story, as is told, we're only going to be able to look at bits of this. It's a marvellous story. I'd love to encourage you to read through it later. If you read through it later, have a look for the beautiful way in which John, the Gospel writer, tells the story. And there's a tremendous emphasis on who sees and who doesn't see, or to put it another way, who knows and who doesn't know. So read through it asking yourself, who gets it at different points and who doesn't get it? Who thinks they know things but don't? And who does know things? Because that, in a way, that's the story. Now, what I want us to notice is three things from the story. And I'm going to pick on various bits of the story just to illustrate them. I want us to notice two reasons why people didn't get it about Jesus, which are also two reasons why people don't get it today, and one reason why one person did get it. The two reasons why people didn't get it were superficiality, and this is the Pharisees. We'll look at them and we'll see the equivalent today. And fear, that is fear of what other people will think. And we'll see that with the man's parents in the story, who we'll come to in a moment. And the reason why one person does get it, and that's the man born blind, is an honest sense of need, not just of physical need with his sight, but of moral need as well. And I want us to notice how some of these things appear. Have a look, if you will, and we're going to have to skip bits of it, but have a look, if you will, at verse 13, page 27, where they bring to the Pharisees. They were the really religious people of Jesus' day, the guys who really cared about right and wrong. And they bring the man who'd been blind, but he's not blind anymore. But the day on which Jesus had made the mud pack, and opened the man's eyes, was a Sabbath. That is to say, he did it on Saturday. And that's really important, because on Saturday, the Pharisees said, you're not allowed to mix stuff. You're not allowed to knead, like making bread or anything like that. And they reckoned that making a mud pack was equivalent to that. So they say, they ask him, verse 15, how he's received his sight. And he says, well, he put mud on my eyes and I washed and now I see. And the Pharisees say immediately, this man is not from God because he doesn't keep the Sabbath. Let me just pause there for a moment. What was going on in their minds? What was going on in their minds was this. God says some stuff's right and some stuff's wrong. And in the Ten Commandments, the fourth commandment is the Sabbath. So they said, God says the Sabbath is right and breaking the Sabbath is wrong. So they said, how are we going to keep that? Well, we need to make sure we understand what keeping the Sabbath means. So they invented lots of other rules. And in a sense, they made the Sabbath commandment much bigger than it originally had been. But actually what they did was they made it much, much more trivial than it had been. So they made the Sabbath commandment, if you like, much wider. So the lot, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't walk this distance, you can't, you know, make a mud pack, all that kind of stuff. But actually in making it much wider with all these extra rules, they'd made it much thinner. Because the commandment was meant to be, like all the Ten Commandments, something that speaks to the heart. And says to us very deeply, think about your motives in life. And the Sabbath commandment, think about rhythms of work and rest. Think about what's going on in your heart if you're a workaholic and you pride yourself on working 24/7, that kind of thing. Sabbath commandment was meant to be getting to the heart, and the Pharisees trivialized it by making it a superficial thing. And that was one reason why they didn't get it about Jesus. So they were faced with an astonishing thing, that a man had been, who'd been born blind and been given his sight. But they said, well, he did it on Saturday, so he can't be from God. And that superficiality stopped them getting it about Jesus. I'll come back to that a little bit later. Now, glance on to verse 17. They turned to the blind man and they said, well, what do you say about this Jesus? Your eyes he opened. And the man said, he's a prophet. He's beginning just to get it about Jesus. But verse 18, the Jews, that is the Jewish leaders, still didn't believe he'd been blind and had received his sight. So they sent for his parents. And look at his parents. They said, is this your son? Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that he can see? And the parents said, verse 20, well, we know he's our son, and we know he was born blind, but how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself. Which was a cop-out, because verse 22, his parents said this because they were afraid. Afraid of the Jews, that's the Jewish leaders. For already they'd decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ, God's King, the Messiah, would be put out of the synagogue. And so what stopped the parents getting it was fear of what people think. Now, the idea, sometimes people have this idea that I'm going to think about Christianity and I'm a kind of independent reasoning mind. And I exist in a kind of bubble all on my own, and I think. And if the arguments are right, I'll be persuaded. Truth is that we're hugely influenced by the people around us. We're hugely influenced by our family, by our work colleagues, by our neighbours, and so on. And one of the reasons that a number of people don't ever commit themselves to Jesus Christ is quite simply, the same as the parents there, fear of what's going to happen with other people. I don't know if any of you see a magazine called Shortlist or a magazine called Stylist. I've just picked up Shortlist, which comes out today. Do any of you see any of those magazines? You want to get shortlist. My son works for shortlist, so I'm very pro shortlist. But stylist is the women's equivalent. And just a week or two ago in Stylist, which is just a normal secular, you know, style magazine, there was an article by someone who I think was a staff member on why it's so hard to be a Christian. This is how her article begins. She said, from sex life to salary, politics to parenting, there's very little that today's women aren't willing to divulge to their colleagues over lunch. And as working hours increase, enforced intimacy means co-workers are even more likely to act as confidants for each other's personal as well as work issues. But however open we've become, there's still one topic some women avoid for fear of being ridiculed or singled out. Religion, or more specifically, Christianity. And then she goes on to describe just how hard it is to say to work colleagues, I'm a Christian. And the strange reactions that she's got to that. Not physical persecution, nobody's beaten her or put her in prison. But the article's all about just how tough it is to be a Christian. And the fear that this man's parents showed is essentially the same reason that some people won't become Christian disciples today. It's not the only reason, of course, but if we're honest, it is a reason for some of us. The story goes on, verse 24, if you look on over the page to verse 24, they summon the man again, and they say, give glory to God, which means they're swearing him in, as it were, to tell the truth on oath. It's like, you know, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And they say, we know this man's a sinner. So don't let the evidence get in the way of a good prejudice, they say. And the man says, I don't know about whether he's a sinner or not. That's beyond me. But I do know one thing. I was blind, but now I see. And there's a wonderful, straightforward honesty about this man, which Jesus' opponents don't have. Lots of stuff I don't understand, but I do understand that. And then it's quite wonderful, really, verse 26. They say, what did you do? How did he open your eyes? And he answered, remember, he's talking to the senior leaders of his people. He answered, I've told you already, and you wouldn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Isn't that marvellous? Which, of course, they see red at that point, and they hurl insults at him. And they say, you're this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. And there's the superficiality again. See, Moses in the Old Testament gave the people of Israel the law, Ten Commandments and all the other laws and stuff there. And they thought that what Moses meant was, you guys try hard enough, be good, keep the law, and you'll be okay with God. Moses never did mean that. It's quite clear from the Old Testament that's not what the Old Testament law meant. But that's what they thought. So their problem was, they had no sense of need of a rescuer. They thought, if we try hard enough, and boy, they did try very hard. If we try to keep the rules hard enough, we're going to be okay with God. And that's one reason, one of the big reasons why they didn't get it about Jesus. But the man born blind, was so beautifully straightforward. He said, I was blind, and now I see. I had a tremendous need that I couldn't possibly meet myself. And Jesus met that need and gave me sight. And so I began to get it. And at the end, there's a wonderful little interview with Jesus. They throw the man out. That is, out of the synagogue, out of society, really. The end of verse 34. And then verse 35, Jesus hears that they've thrown him out. And he comes and he finds him. And he says, do you believe in the Son of Man, which was a title of Jesus? It meant a human being, but it also meant a very great human being. And the man said, verse 36, who is he, sir? Because the man doesn't know that the man talking to him is the man who healed him. Tell me that I may believe in him. Sorry, no, he knows it's the one who's healed him, but he's never seen him before. First time he's seen him after getting his sight. And Jesus said, you've now seen him. In fact, he's the one speaking with you. But notice what the man says. He says, tell me so that I may believe. So the Pharisees said, it doesn't matter what you tell me, I'm not going to believe. Because I'm pretty confident I can cope with life on my own. I've got no sense of need. I reckon I can be good enough for God. And the man said, tell me, there's so much stuff I don't understand, but if you tell me, I'd love to believe. I'd love to trust the person who's done such a wonderful thing for me. And the man said, verse 38, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him wonderfully. And then there's the punchline, verse 39. Jesus said, for judgment I've come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. Well, the blind seeing is this man, isn't it? This man's a picture of that. He's a man who has a sense that he actually has a real sense of moral need. Not just physical need, but moral need. He needs a rescuer. And that's the way to Christian faith. The way to Christian faith is saying, enlightenment is not something I can do with my clever mind. Enlightenment is being moved from moral darkness to moral light. And that's something that I need a saviour and rescuer to do for me. But Jesus goes on, those who see will become blind. And straight afterwards, verse 40, some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this. And they knew he was getting at them. And they asked, what? Are we blind too? They were kind of sensitive about this. And Jesus said, if you were blind, if you were really blind, you wouldn't be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains. In other words, they are blind, but they don't know that they're blind. And they claim they can see. So these Pharisees, because they've got a superficial view of human morality and human evil and good, they think they can do it on their own. They think they can see. They think they've got it. And therefore, they're guilty and they remain in darkness. Now, that means that in one sense, Christopher Hitchens is right. He's quite right that human religion makes people very arrogant. You know, the cartoon fundamentalist, the person who's absolutely sure that they've got all absolute truth and they've got it all, makes for a tremendous arrogance. That's the Pharisees. The Pharisees were like that. They were very arrogant. They were very sure that they got everything absolutely right. But real Christianity is the attitude of this blind man who says, there's so much stuff I haven't got. So much stuff I don't understand. But I do know that I was blind and Jesus has made me see. I do know that I needed a saviour and I found one. Now that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I wanted to encourage us to think if we're, I mean, it may be that, I'm sure you're not looking at you, but it may be, it's just possible out there, there are people who never think about life at all. I mean, there are some people, aren't there, who just sort of go around head down, working 24/7, never thinking about life and the meaning of life and the future and what happens after we die and these big questions. You guys, I don't think you'd be here if you were like that. But there's if we think about these big questions, what I think this bit of the Bible is saying to us is this. It's saying it's not just a question of intellectual darkness and intellectual enlightenment up here. Because if that was the case, the enlightened people would probably be the clever people. It's tough on the rest of us. It's a question of moral darkness. Stuff that's wrong in my heart and stuff that's wrong in my life. And moral light. And Jesus said that what Jesus does with this blind man is a picture of what he does for those who will humbly come to him and say, I need to be given sight. And a Christian is a man or woman who says, there's loads of stuff I don't understand. Every Christian carries around bundles of questions with them, every honest Christian. But I do know one thing, that I was blind, and Jesus has given me sight. He's given me forgiveness, he's given me new life, and that's a wonderful thing. Let me stop there. I forgot to look at my watch at the beginning, Marcus, so I've no idea how long I've gone on. So I'm going to stop.
Thanks, Christopher. So we're going to have dessert and coffee now. You might like to pick up on things around tables and chat about them. But in particular, if you've got questions to ask, we're going to have a Q&A session just to round off the evening. And the way we'd like you to do it is to write down your questions, please, on some grey slips on your tables or a pens there as well. So if you've got any questions at all related to what Christopher was talking about, or even just sort of more vaguely related to the Christian faith and big questions of life, there'll be 15 minutes at the end to do that. But please do jot your questions down now, and then we'll collect them together for that final bit. Thank you. Okay, everyone. Sorry to interrupt your conversations again.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, speaking.
Sorry to butt in again, folks. Thank you for all your questions. We'll get to those in just a moment. Before Christopher answers the questions you've submitted, we thought it might be interesting just to hear from someone their own story of how they became a Christian, just so we can see someone today rather than just someone in the Bible and their experience. This is Clayton. Just tell us, Clayton, briefly where you come from and what you do and that sort of stuff.
From Australia. I've been living in the UK for about 6 years now. And I'm a tax accountant, so very exciting. That wasn't a joke. And I work near Aldgate Station, so not too far from here.
Okay. So just tell us a little bit then about life for you before you became a Christian. So, you know, what was your view of God and Christianity? What was life like and so on?
Yeah, I guess growing up, I didn't grow up in a religious family, so we didn't go to church or anything like that. My parents, for some reason, though, still sent my sister and I to Sunday school when we were young. We went had scripture and that at school and once a week after school. I think from that I didn't really have any idea of who God was or who Jesus was, but I think it left me knowing that there was a God. I believed in heaven, I believed in hell. I guess I didn't really know who God was. I definitely didn't have any kind of relationship with God. But yeah, I guess, like many people, I think I just felt, you know, heaven is real. I want to go to heaven. I need to be a good person. And being a good person was all you had to do to go to heaven. I didn't think organized religion was a good thing. I thought it was a bit outdated and irrelevant. And pretty much I think the Bible as well, I thought, was something that was quite outdated and didn't need it in my life. I just needed to be a good person.
So what made the difference? You're a Christian today. Just tell us briefly how did that come about?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Canberra. And after university, I moved up to Sydney, started work, and became friends with a few people there, and some of them were Christians. And they were openly Christian, and they even went to church, which was something I'd never come across before. So I'd never had a friend that was a regular church-going Christian. So that was something that was different and interesting. And I became quite close friends with them, and then one day after a while, they invited me to this talk that was on in the city. So I went along, and I listened, and for the first time, I think I heard the Bible actually being taught. And it was something that really stood out to me. Something rang true inside me. It didn't seem so irrelevant anymore. So I thought, well, you know, I need to look into this a bit further. So with a bit of encouragement from my friends, I started going to a church. I did a short course on one of the gospel books in the Bible. And then, you know, just over time, I sort of began to learn who God was. Sort of began to learn who Jesus was. And I guess, yeah, I came to realise that despite, you know, my rejection of God for 27 years, that he did love me. Yeah, he did love me, and he sent Jesus to die for me and for my sins, despite my rejection of him for 27 years. So, yeah, I guess at that point I realised I needed to turn around and start trusting in him.
And in terms of life since, so what sort of things would you say have changed in your life since becoming a Christian? What have been the good things, the difficult things?
Yeah, I guess that's strange. I don't think I've, in some ways, I haven't really changed a whole lot. I think my general character is I'm the same person. Not a whole lot has changed, but I think on other times I've changed, like, completely. My whole reason for doing things, my goals, my motivations are completely different. So I think it's when you no longer live for yourself and you're sort of living for Jesus, things take on a real different characteristic, and you keep trying to live for Jesus. You keep trying to live the way he wants you to live. And through the Bible, you can get to know how it is Jesus wants you to live. So I think you sort of, yeah, turn aside from those selfish desires of just, what do I want, what's for me, and living for Jesus. It's not always easy. It's quite difficult sometimes, and I keep messing up probably every day. But, yeah, you know, you keep trusting in Jesus, you keep coming back to him, he keeps forgiving you, and, yeah, you just keep growing through all the challenges and just keep going day by day.
Great. Thanks, Clayton, very much. Great to hear your... So, over to Christopher and your questions.
Thank you, Clayton, very much. Well, thank you for those who've put questions in. Well, I suppose it's thank you. I could go home earlier if you hadn't, but I've tried to put them in some kind of an order, so at least I put like with like. Somebody's written, I've heard that people have chosen books out of lots of books to make the Bible. In other words, that you know, in the early centuries, the church decided which books would be in the Bible. How can we be sure the words chosen by people were all inspired by God? And the questioner says that they're a Christian. They do trust the Bible, but it's a bit frustrating to know that the books were chosen by people. Thank you for asking that. Whoever asked that, it's a really helpful question. It's very interesting that there's a huge difference between the way Christian people think the Bible came into existence and the way, as I understand it, Islam says the Quran came into existence. That, as I understand it, the Quran is supposed to have been given by dictation from God. I think that's right, isn't it? Tell me, you know, if I'm wrong later. Whereas Christian people have always believed that the Bible writers were loads of different people over loads of different centuries. And you read the Bible books and they're in different styles and the personalities of the writers come through them. And they're, you know, they're very, very different. But wonderfully, their message is harmonious. They're telling the same story all the way through. And it's perfectly true that, of course, lots of other Christianish books have been written, and some were written in the early days, and Jewishish books were written. You know, you find some of them in the Apocrypha and some of them outside the Apocrypha. I've got some of them on my bookshelves. There's lots of other stuff out there. And what the Jews first and then the early church did was to recognize which books were reliable. Now, for the New Testament, they did it very simply. They said which books were either written by the apostles of Jesus or were written by people who were reliably writing down the apostles' teaching. That was the test of whether a book could be included or not. So something like the so-called Gospel of Thomas that you might have heard about, it claimed to be written by an apostle but clearly wasn't. And if you read some of these other books, actually, you don't need to be terribly bright to see that they're just weirdly different. And then you read the Gospels in the New Testament and you think there's a kind of sanity and straightforwardness about them that you just don't get in the others. We can't prove that the Bible's written by God, you know, inspired by God. If you could, then the Bible wouldn't be our authority. Whatever you use to prove it would be our authority. But it's reasonable to trust that the Bible is a trustworthy witness to Jesus and the things of Jesus. Do come back on me. Come back at me later if that's not helpful. A couple of people have picked up on this thing in verse 39 of John chapter 9. Somebody says, "Does God or Jesus make people blind today? Does he make people not see today?" And someone else has said, please explain again the meaning of verse 39, those who see will become blind. Now, I deliberately chose a shocking verse like that, in a sense, to get us thinking about this. In Jesus' day, what was happening was that the Pharisees, particularly, because they had this very shallow view of human nature, and they didn't really understand how deeply messed up we are inside, or in the Bible's word, sinful we are. Therefore, when perfect goodness walked amongst them, they hated it. Or they hated him. And so in that sense, they became blind. You know, they just became blinder and blinder, even though they thought they could see. Now, I take it that is there in the Bible because that same process happens today. That when a man or woman sees, not that we see perfect goodness, you know, amongst Christian people, but when in the Bible we read the life of Jesus and we see the sheer love and beauty and goodness of Jesus' life, it's possible for us to turn our backs on that and say, there's no way I want that because I want to keep living for myself. And if we do that, we'll gradually go blinder and blinder in terms of a spiritual sense. So I take it that shockingly, that does still happen today. Can I go on without being interrupted? Is that all right? Is that the deal? It's not like Parliament. It's much easier than Parliament, this, isn't it? I bet David Cameron would get a lot to be able just to talk without being interrupted. Someone's put this question. In a society that relies so heavily on logic and intellect, what advice would you give to Christians in the workplace to witness and proclaim their faith? Being constantly confronted by disbelief and disinterest can be hard. It's a really good question, isn't it? And I guess the question is picking up on what I was saying about light and darkness not being just intellectual categories, but being moral categories. And I guess, I mean, it's a challenge for those of us who are Christians, this. But I guess the thing I want to say is that people aren't going to be persuaded to become Christians usually by purely intellectual arguments, because there's plenty more going on in us. So you can give me the most brilliant Christian arguments in the world, but if I don't want to believe, I'm not going to believe. But what's much more powerful is when Christian lives are so distinctive that people have their consciences awakened. And when somebody begins to realize, I'm worse than I thought I was, and I really do need forgiveness, and actually this matters, this isn't just an academic discussion, then people will begin to pay attention. And we can't engineer this. But I guess I want to say, as Christians, it's the moral, it's the sheer goodness of Jesus and the sheer goodness of following in Jesus' footsteps. That's what's going to make people pay attention more than intellectual arguments. There is a place for intellectual arguments. There's a place for showing people that it's reasonable to be a Christian. You don't need to leave your brain behind. But it's not the kind of cutting edge thing. Which links with a couple of questions. A couple of people have asked, somebody said, is being a good person not enough? And someone asked, why, if my life is so good, do I need Jesus? Which I guess in a way is the question that the Pharisees would have asked. They'd have said, isn't our law keeping good enough? Surely I'm a good enough neighbour, I'm a good enough person, I give to charity, I'm helpful to people, I'm honest at work and so on, I don't sleep around, all sorts of things like that. I'm a good enough person. Do I need a rescuer? And I guess the thing about real Christian faith is that real Christian faith begins to wake us up to the fact that any goodness I might have is really terribly superficial. And that even if, in my case, I had a stable home and upbringing. I've had a privileged life, really. In many ways, life's been very, very easy for me. And there's all sorts of reasons why I haven't murdered anybody, for example. Because from my background and so on, there's lots of reasons why I wouldn't. But in my heart, there is sometimes the sort of anger which in other circumstances would have made me murder somebody. And similarly with adultery, I haven't, by God's grace, slept with anybody except my wife. But the stuff's there in my heart which would have made me do that if I hadn't been constrained by other things. And real Christianity makes us look into our hearts and say, actually, the bad stuff that we read about in the tabloids, and we love saying those guys are so bad and thank God I'm so good, actually, it's not like that at all. Actually, we look at bad stuff around and we say, actually, all that bad stuff's there in my heart as well. And then I realise I need a rescuer. Which links with the next question. Someone says, what makes Christianity so much better or right compared to other religions? Which, again, is a really good question, really helpful question. And there's stuff, a Christian would say that there's stuff that some other religions say that's right. There's moral stuff. Some other religions will say that, you shouldn't murder people, for example, in which case they're right to say you shouldn't murder people. What's different is that Christianity is a rescue religion.
And I think in one way or another, every other religion in some way is a religion which says, by either doing religious things or moral things, I'm going to kind of climb up some ladder and kind of get to God. Well, Buddhism doesn't believe in God. It doesn't believe in any gods. But I'm going to get to something worthwhile, a sort of religious kind of thing. Whereas Christianity says, I can try climbing up as much as I like, but I'm not going to get very far. And what I need is a rescuer to come down. And so that's the key difference, really, that God has sent a rescuer. And then the last question, somebody has put, I don't know if this is a joke, but they put, what is the meaning of life? Do you think they want to keep us here for a long time? Let me give a sort of John's Gospel answer to this. I tell you what, I've really been struck with reading John's Gospel. And I would, you know, can they take these John's Gospels away? Take a John's Gospel away and just quietly read it through. And I tell you the thing that's really fired up me, because I've been kind of reading John's Gospel a lot this year, and it's this. It's the idea that right at the heart of the universe, there is God the Father and God the Son and God the Holy Spirit living in an extraordinary sort of harmony of love. Wonderful harmony of love, like a kind of beautiful friendship. You know, sometimes you see a friendship which is really good. You see two or three friends who just seem to be really together and in harmony with one another. Take that to its ultimate extreme. You've got that fellowship of love. And the message of John's Gospel is that through Jesus coming to earth and dying on the cross, that fellowship, that community of love has been opened up to any man or woman who will trust in Jesus and become a disciple. And that wonderfully, we're brought into that fellowship of love. And as John says in his first letter, we have fellowship with God the Father and with Jesus. And that's a wonderful thing. And I guess in a sense, that's a sort of John's Gospel answer to what's the meaning of life. Marcus, I'm going to stop. While the going's good, I'm going to stop.
As Christopher said, the John's Gospels are for you to take away, so please do take them and read them. Many people would say that, oh yeah, I know basically what it's on about, but have never actually read through, say, one of the Gospel accounts with an adult mind. So we just encourage you to take up the challenge, take it away, have a read through and see what you make of it. We also run a course here on the barge called Christianity Explored, which is an introduction to the Christian faith. DVD-based presentation, chance to ask any questions that you've got in a small group setting. And we run that in the evenings. We also run it at lunchtimes. And the next courses are beginning soon. If that's of interest to you, there's a little beige slip on your tables, a response slip, and you can ask for more information by filling that in. And just drop it in the wicker basket on the stairs on the way out. So the evening course actually begins this next Tuesday. It's a 10-session course, but we'd say come along to the first session. See if it fits. If not, we're not going to sort of chase you up for the remaining nine and send the boys around sort of thing, so it's up to you. The other thing you could do, if you'd like to find out a little bit more, is Christopher's speaking here on Sunday. So we meet every Sunday here on the barge at 4 o'clock, and then a repeat service at 6:30. And this coming week, Christopher is going to speak for the last in this series of Navigate, Finding Your Way in Today's World. The topic for Sunday is, where can I find security? We can't promise you any food on Sunday, certainly not a sit-down meal. There'll be bakes and stuff, but Christopher will be back to speak. There's also, just a final thing to say, is a little table with books on over there. In addition to the John's Gospels, there's also some little blue books called The Real Jesus. Please do take one of those with our compliments as well. And then at the back there are a few more books if you want to dig a little bit deeper. That's probably enough by way of information and notices. Just remains for me to say a few thank yous. Big thank you to Christopher for being with us this evening and speaking. Thanks to the Good Eating Company, who've provided the amazing food for us. I think the chefs are back behind those doors somewhere, but do say thank you to them if you see them on the way out on the pontoon. And thank you to all of you for coming, and we do hope we can welcome you back on board at some point in the near future. So thank you very much. Do feel free to stay around and have further drinks and so on. Thank you.